This audio file is a production of Chiasmos, the University of Chicago's International and Area Studies Multimedia Outreach Source. For related audio and video, or for more information about the project, please visit chiasmos.uchicago.edu or internationalstudies.uchicago.edu.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming out on this rainy night. My name is Jamie Bender, and I am the Outreach Coordinator here at University of Chicago Center for International Studies. On behalf of our center, International House, and the Seminary Co-op Bookstore, it's a pleasure to welcome you to this World Beyond the Headlines lecture event. Before getting started, I want to mention our next lecture, which will be held on May 15th. That's a Thursday at 6 p.m., also here in Assembly Hall at the International House, where Jimmy Briggs will be discussing his book, Innocence Lost: When Child Soldiers Go to War. You can find more information on that lecture, as well as all of the World Beyond the Headline lectures, on the Center for International Studies website. We certainly hope you will be able to join us for Jimmy Briggs' talk as well. Tonight's event is being audio and video recorded for broadcast on the web. You will be able to download the event for free by going to the University of Chicago's International and Area Studies Multimedia Outreach Source, also known as Chiasmos, at chiasmos.uchicago.edu. We hope that it will be able to be downloaded in approximately 3 to 4 weeks. If you go on the site, you can also type in your email address, and it will alert you of recent posts. Tonight, we are very lucky to have David Rothkopf with us. He is a widely acclaimed author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. He is the president and chief executive of Garton Rothkopf, an international advisory firm, a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and a teacher of international affairs at Columbia University's Graduate School of International and Public Affairs. His new book, Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making, tells the story of today's superclass that has achieved unprecedented levels of wealth and power. Each member of this superclass is literally close to one in a million, numbering 6,000 on a planet of just under 7 billion people. Superclass is the first in-depth examination of the connections between the global communities of leaders who are at the helm of every major enterprise on the planet and control its greatest wealth. It is an unprecedented examination of trends within the superclass, which are likely to alter our politics, our institutions, and the shape of the world in which we live. Certainly a very interesting analysis. Please join me in welcoming David Rothkopf.
Well, thanks to all of you for heroically venturing out into this abominable weather. As I came in from the airport, it was snowing. And it was 84 on Saturday, so I'm a little confused. But I will try to regain my bearings and talk to you a little bit about the book and the ideas in the book, and then maybe we can have a little bit of a conversation among us. Let me start by saying this is not one of those books about the richest of the rich. It's not one of those books about how, you know, a few people live lives of unimaginable luxury. Some of the people in the book are those richest of the rich. And some of them do live those kind of lives of unimaginable luxury. But this is a book about globalization. And it's a book about power and the changing nature of power in the world. And the real thrust of the book came because when I was doing my last book, I went around, and the last book was called Running the World, and somebody would always stand up in the audience and they would say, "That's the trouble with you people in Washington. You think you're running the world." And, you know, the book was on how foreign policy is made in the White House, but the title was more or less ironic because I don't actually think the United States or anybody in the United States is running the world. But when the time came to do another book, There'd been so much interest in this particular idea, I thought, well, who is, if anybody is, and how is the power structure of the world changing? And I thought back a little bit on a book that I studied when I was in college called The Power Elite, which was by a Columbia professor. I went to Columbia, and the professor looked at the interlocking power structure of the United States in the 1950s. And what he found was that the people who ran the business community, the people who ran the political community, and the people that ran the military, the people that ran other influential communities in the United States, were a very, very small group. Many of them knew each other. Many of them came from one group to the next group. There was what he described as a kind of an interlocking directorate. Of course, when he was writing this book in 1956 at Columbia University, the president of the United States was Dwight Eisenhower, who had previously been the president of Columbia University, and prior to that had been the supreme Allied commander in Europe, and so was a perfectly good example of this interlocking directorship. And 4 years later, Eisenhower would give a speech when he was leaving office on the military-industrial complex, and he too saw this coalescing of power. But what's struck me was that if Mills were writing the book today, he'd be writing about a completely different group of people. It's not that there aren't elites in the United States. There clearly are. But the elite of the elite, the most powerful people in the world, are part of a new kind of community. And although there have always been elites in the world, this new community is different from what's happened in the past in a lot of really, really important ways. Notably, they are a global elite. They are the most globalized community on Earth. They are the community that is driving globalization. But they're different in other ways as well. For example, if you were to look at international elites 30 years ago, what you'd find was primarily the international marketplace or the international arena was dominated by people from the public sector, from governments. But today, the international elite is dominated from the private sector. In fact, when I looked at this group, 60% of them were from the private sector. It also found an amazing concentration of power. I mean, really mind-boggling. When Mills wrote the book in 1956, the defense budget of the United States was very big. It was Cold War. It was so big, in fact, that the defense budget of the United States was greater than the annual sales of every major in the company in the United States added up. So it gives you a sense of how big companies were relative to the government. Today, the defense budget of the United States is bigger in real dollar terms than it has been at any time since 1944, which is a real achievement when you consider that was during a world war. But it's smaller by 50% than the annual sales of just the two largest companies in the United States, Walmart and Exxon. Exxon is so big as a company that its annual sales are roughly the equivalent of the GDP of the 19th largest country in the world. Its annual profits are bigger than the GDP of Bahrain and Yemen added up together. The biggest companies in the world, because markets seek scale, because that's what, you know, markets seek efficiency and scale gives you efficiency. The biggest companies, the 250 biggest companies in the world, have sales that are the equivalent of one-third of global GDP. The 50 biggest financial institutions in the world control $48.5 trillion in assets, one-third of all the assets on the planet. So it's very, very big, big organizations. If you looked at the world and you divided it, you just said, I want to take the biggest organizations and let's use as a rule of thumb organizations that have annual sales greater than $50 billion a year or GDP, you know, greater than $50 billion a year. And of course, I know the GDP and annual sales are not anything like each other, but it gives you a rule, you know, just a kind of a thumbnail sketch. 106 of them are companies. 60 of them are countries. In other words, the biggest companies in the world are bigger and economically more powerful than all but a handful of countries in the world. And this has never happened before. And it is there, you know, this kind of concentration, consolidation of power has happened in a lot of other areas as well. I mean, it's happened in defense. There are only 30 or 40 countries in the world that have weapons of mass destruction. There are only 20 countries in the world that have missiles. There are only 9 or 10, depending on how you're counting, countries in the world that have nuclear weapons. There are only 3 countries in the world that have air forces with over 1,000 members in them. There's only 1 country in the world that has the ability to truly wage a global war or a war in space. And that country, the country in which you live, spends more money on defense than every other country in the world added up together. Okay? That country's allies in NATO spend 85% of all the money that's being spent in the world on defense. The top 10 defense contractors in the world, which are responsible for most of the major defense sales in the world, are all located in NATO. But you see this concentration everywhere. In religion, there are 4,300 religions in the world. The top 20, however, are the only ones with over 1 million adherents each. There are only 2 with over 1 billion adherents. And so as you look at this group, you see this kind of 20-80 rule, this Pareto principle. So, it's reductive. So it within every 20, there's another 20-80 rule. And so there's always a smaller and smaller group that is really in charge. And when you see it, look at the group of companies that are out there, you see this strikingly, not just in terms of, say, those 250 companies or those 50 financial institutions, but if you just take, say, the boards of the top 5 of those 50 companies and the senior management, maybe 70 people, those 70 people also serve on the boards of 150 of the largest companies in the world and 25 of the largest universities in the world. So it's a very, very close-knit community. And what's happened in the global era is that that community has gone on to the global stage, particularly the private community, and seen that what differentiates this era from all others is not just the power of this elite, but that there's no countervailing force. Throughout history, in fact, much of history is the story of the rise of elites. They overreach, and then they're offset. In ancient Greece, I look at it in China, I look at it in the United States in the period of the robber barons. In the robber baron period, the John D. Rockefellers of this world rose up. He controlled 90% of the oil market in the United States through Standard Oil. And Ida Tarbell and Theodore Roosevelt and the other trust busters came in and they said, we have to break them up. And there were laws to do that. Because these super empowered robber barons were still operating under an umbrella of national sovereignty. And there are ways of offsetting them and breaking up their power. But that doesn't exist on the global stage. They don't operate under the umbrella of national sovereignty. In fact, many of them have recognized that they operate over it, so that companies can now play countries against one another and say, I'm not going to invest in your country unless you change your laws to suit me, unless you reduce your taxes, unless you make more lax your environmental regulations. And so the whole power balance of the planet has shifted, and this group has stepped into the void. They've stepped into that place in the kind of no states land of the global economy, and they filled the void with informal clusters of people. And we've seen, you know, you can't think of a better example of how this works than in the recent financial crisis. Recent's probably not the best word. The current financial crisis, because we've just seen the beginning of it, and I think we are going to see over the course of the next year or two successive shock after shock after shock in global financial markets, and we can get to that. We'll talk about that at the end if you want to, but what happened was the global financial elites said, hey, look, we want to operate on this global stage without all these regulations. We'll self-regulate. And, you know, which is kind of interesting, since if you ask one of these people to get into a self-regulating taxi cab or brush their teeth with self-regulating toothpaste, they wouldn't think of doing it. But they said, no, you know, we're better than that. Let us go out there and we'll self-regulate. And there has been this profusion of markets in all sorts of new kinds of complicated securities where the risk is so hard to identify. In fact, in derivatives markets, which are $30 to $40 trillion by the most conservative estimate, you can't even tell who the counterparty is in the deal. So you can't know what the risk is in the deal, which is what the minimum requirement for any investor ought to be. But there's been this profusion, and mortgage-backed securities were a big part of this thing. But the real demonstration of the power of this group came when first they were able to shrug off national governments getting too into the regulation of these global markets, and then when there was a crisis, they were able to pick up the phone and get the national governments to come in and start cauterizing the wound of investment banks long before they were doing anything substantive for people who actually owned homes. And the argument was, well, this is a systemic risk. But it's the same system. At one end of the system are people, you know, taking out mortgages on their homes. And on the other end, there are people who package them together and are trading components of them. But they had the power to say, stay out, and then the power to go to people who didn't regulate them, who had no actual responsibility for them, and say, help us out here. Interestingly, the even greater power comes when you look at how the system was managed during the crisis. Tim Geithner, who I talked to, I knew in the Clinton administration, is the president of the New York Fed. And he said, my greatest power at this point, because you know, governments don't have that much cash to go into markets and stop the bleeding of a big market when there's trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars going through it every day, is convening power. So he has a conference room down the hall, and he gets together representatives of the 14 biggest financial institutions. And in fact, Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, calls them the 14 families in a kind of whimsical reference to The Godfather. I don't know if you find that Gesundheit. I don't know if you find that as funny as he might have. But you know, they get these people together and they say, look, we need your help. Collaborate with us. Governments have to ask the big financial institutions to collaborate in order to solve a crisis like this. They can't tell them to, they can't intervene, they don't have authority. You know, governments are like your dog in your yard with the, you know, invisible fence. You know, every time they get to the border, they start to yelp because they, you know, sovereignty only goes so far. And so you end up in a situation where the private sector is able to set the rules, influence the outcome, and you know, I haven't even gotten into the ability of people in these big institutions to influence politics. And we in the United States live in the most perverse political system in the world in some respects because it's so dependent on money. I mean, it's great to turn on the TV and read about the Indiana primary or to read about the North Carolina primary, but you don't get to be in those primaries unless, in 2007, you won the money primary. You were viewed by people as being credible. Even the Barack Obama campaign and other campaigns that use grassroots funding can't play the game unless they've got big bundlers and people bringing cash in. They've got to go to the same people and ask for their advice. You also see the revolving door phenomenon that Mills talked about in spades in this world. Treasury Secretary of the United States, who presided over this, Hank Paulson, very sophisticated guy, was the CEO of Goldman Sachs. His predecessor as the CEO of Goldman Sachs was the chief economic advisor to George Bush. His predecessor as the CEO of Goldman Sachs was the chief economic advisor to Bill Clinton and the Secretary of the Treasury. His predecessor, who was an underachiever, was just the senator from New Jersey and then the governor of New Jersey. Another former Goldman Sachs alum is now the president of the World Bank. The list goes on and on and on. There is a very, very small community, and every ex-Treasury Secretary of the United States right now is serving on a board of a hedge fund. And when you want to talk about concentration of power, 30 to 50% of all equity trading in the world is controlled by 10,000 hedge funds. But 85% of all the assets of those 10,000 hedge funds are controlled by 300 hedge funds. And 60% are controlled by 100 hedge funds. So there is a tiny, tiny group that really is dominating how markets move. Is that power beyond economics? Well, sure it is. Because how do CEOs get paid? CEOs get paid based on the return their stocks make. And the return their stocks make is based on this trading, which is left to a tiny group of people. And we've seen the interlocking nature of the leadership in the business community. And so you've got this remarkable period in which, for the first time in history, elites have floated above national sovereignty. And they're out in a space where there's no countervailing force, and they're able to use their influence to move us more and more in a variety of directions. Now, round about now, I look out into the crowd and I notice a few people who are a little more agitated than others, you know, possibly off their medication, who, not in this crowd, but in others, those folks didn't come out in the bad weather, but you know, who start saying, well, this proves what I've always believed about the conspiracy theory. So tell me, how do the Freemasons do this? Or how do the Illuminati do this? Or how does the World Jewish Conspiracy do this? And, you know, believe me, I mean, I was a Jewish boy growing up in New Jersey. I heard about the World Jewish Conspiracy, and I thought, that's for me. I want in. You know, there weren't many Jews, and I thought, well, you know, this could be a great opportunity for me. I could control something not too flashy, Canada, world sorghum market, something. But the reality, of course, was, A, doesn't exist. I mean, and the best evidence of that is, you know, things haven't gone so well for the Jews for hundreds of years. And, you know, I think, frankly, were there a world Jewish conspiracy, we probably could have done a better job than has been done. But all of these theories don't bear out. All of these theories don't bear out. Because the people who have the most power are incredibly self-interested and often rivals with one another. And where their real power comes from is someplace entirely different. It comes from when their interests align. It comes from when dozens or scores or hundreds of the most powerful people in the world decide that in their self-interest, they'd like to see an outcome. And because they are so much more powerful than the rest of us, they can move things in that direction. Politics, political debate. I think the best example is that over the course of the past 30 years and the declining years of the Cold War and in its wake, we've seen the world move into a kind of a philosophical bent in many countries. And of course, it's varying degrees. It's worse in the United States and less so in other places. But overall, which might be called Reagan-Thatcherism, or it might be called Volcker-Greenspanism, or as somebody once said, it might be called Friedman-Friedmanism, for Milton Friedman here at the University of Chicago and Tom Friedman. You could call it market-marketism. You know, in other words, leave it to the market. Government doesn't work, leave it to the market. Markets will take care of things. Markets are the things that provide us growth. Ultimately, markets will make everything better for everybody. And indeed, over the course of the 30 years that we've taken this approach, there's been growth in the world. And indeed, over the 30 years that we've taken this approach, the poorest as a group have shrunk. The bottom has risen a little bit. And people have said, look, this is working. Let's stick with it. And big companies, big financial institutions, their advocates on the global stage have said, globalization gives us an opportunity not to make the mistakes of the past. Let's not regulate. Let's let markets do their thing. Let's use this opportunity in this no states land to get out there and really let unfettered markets solve all of our problems. The problem is, that's just not what happened. What happened was, over the past 30 years, inequality has grown in the world to unprecedented levels. Every kind of inequality. Inequality between countries has grown. So 100 years ago, at the end of the robber baron era, when you really thought things were bad, the richest countries in the world were about 9 times richer than the poorest countries in the world. Today, they're over 100 times richer. Just 30 years ago, the richest country in the world, which back then in the good old days was the United States of America on a per capita GDP basis, was about 88 times richer than the poorest country in the world, which back then was Bangladesh. Today, it's 270 times richer. By the way, the richest country on per capita GDP basis is Luxembourg. 270 times richer than the poorest. In the island of Manhattan, not considered the third world, unless you've spent some time there, but on the island of Manhattan, it used to be that the top fifth were 9 times richer than the bottom fifth. Today, they're 90 times richer than the bottom fifth. In the 70s, it used to be a CEO made 35 times more than the average employee. Today, a CEO makes 350 times more than an average employee. You think that's bad? I got an email last night from an economist who read the book, and he liked the book. I was glad to see that, since I'm an English major, and when I write a book on, you know, economics, it's nice to get feedback from people who can count. And he, you know, he said that during the days of ancient Rome, when we think about excess, Roman generals made 67 times what Roman foot soldiers made. So today's CEO makes 5 times more than that particular gap. We've seen it in the benefits, how benefits have accrued. Look at the United States during the biggest expansion in our history. Bottom 90% saw their incomes rise 2%. The top 1/100th of a percent saw their incomes rise 112%. Okay? I mean, to be the top paid hedge fund manager in the world last year, how much money do you think he had to make? No. $3 billion. In your pay packet, this isn't like how much your fund made. This, the top, George Soros made over $2 billion last year. By the way, you'll be comforted or antagonized to know that the guy who made the $3 billion did it by betting against mortgage markets. Apparently, unlike the Bush administration, it was possible to predict that U.S. mortgage markets were going to go south. I'm being facetious. It was obvious that U.S. mortgage markets were going to go south. 2 years ago, 70% of the mortgages written in California were negative amortization mortgages. I mean, it's outrageous. Shouldn't have been allowed. But it was allowed because people created a system where the risk was able to be spread out into a global financial, you know, superstructure and never seen again. And so they just became distant from it. But in example after example, inequality has grown. What else has happened? Middle classes have shrunk. In every country in the world except India and China, over the past 30 years, the middle class has shrunk. The middle class is the basis of stability in society, and they've shrunk. In India and China, because they're so big, and remember, markets seek scale, it's been slightly different, although the Indian middle class, you know, they can make a couple thousand dollars a year. It's a slightly different situation. But even in China, inequality has exploded. China has created, in the past year, more billionaires than any place in the world. By one Chinese measure, they've gone from 16 to 106 billionaires. Okay, there's a major class of millionaires in China emerging. But they're much further away from the bottom than the top in China has ever been. The number that really, you know, that starts to get to me is when you start looking at who owns the assets in the planet. The vast majority of assets on the planet are owned by the top 10%. 85% of all the assets on the planet are owned by the top 10% of the people. The majority of the assets on the planet are owned by the top 2%. The top 1% of people on the planet own 40% of all the assets on the planet. The top 1,100 people, the billionaires on the planet, have a net worth that's almost double that of the bottom 2.5 billion. I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling where we have come because of the trend here. Now, some people say, well, you know, how do you draw direct cause and effect between the concentration of power and this growing inequality? And of course, you know, in the book, I do draw some lines there. But, you know, how can you deny that if there is a group of people that has so much more power and it plays so much of a bigger role in determining what public policies are around the world and how globalization works around the world, that they don't bear some responsibility for this? And so we drill down, and, you know, part of the book, I mean, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm throwing out statistics, I'm trying to paint a picture, trying to get you a little outraged, trying to give you some time to dry off. But the book is a story of people. Because these aren't, you know, this is not, you know, some remote group. These are people. They gather. You can go. You can meet among them. You can see who they are. We know their names, you know. And so part of the book deals with where they meet, the places where they're knit together in a community, the places like Davos and Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission and some of the places that you don't know about, and you know, tries to explode some of the myths, because the reality is, you know, these places aren't that interesting, to be absolutely honest. I've gone to Davos for 6 or 7 of the past few years, and you know, you go there, and I was talking to Steve Case, who founded AOL, about it, and Steve Case said, you know, I have this funny feeling. I go to Davos, and I always feel like there's something interesting happening someplace else. You know, and you get that sense, you know, there are 2,000 really important people there, and you can sort of see Angelina Jolie or Bill Gates somewhere in the crowd. But then you go into a room and there's a speech going on, and you think, this can't be it. The reality is, I don't, you know, after 6 years or 7 years, I don't think it actually is happening someplace else. I think that what you've got is an event which is notable, A, because it helps these people to see each other and knit each other together. But B is more important, as you know, as I sometimes refer to it, as kind of the factory where conventional wisdom is made. Because the greatest power of this elite is the power to set the agenda. And they come together in a place like this and they say, look, you know, how do you feel about Iraq? How do you feel about the global economy? How do you feel about climate change? And they get a sense of how others in their group, other peers, are feeling. When they go back with the views that they've gathered there or at other meetings, it's got a big impact. Now, some of these meetings used to be very important in the early days of knitting this group together, Bilderberg or the Trilateral Commission, but many of them are attended by people who are formers or exes or soon to be the late. And, you know, many of these meetings are kind of past their sell-by date. They're not reflective of the new elite, in large part because the new elite is increasingly Asian. And, you know, Davos has had only single-digit Asian attendance for a long time, and although they're trying to set up other meetings, if you know, the Forbes list, the most billionaires created last year were in Russia, China, and India. So if those people aren't in the room, you're sort of missing the trend. And I think one of the important changes to look for is, what will it mean if the people who set the agenda come from a completely different cultural tradition than the transatlantic tradition that we're used to? You know, we come from a Western proselytizing tradition where we believe we are right and we want to change the world to be like us. This is a European gift, which, you know, was tied to, you know, converting peoples and imposing their systems of government and so forth. It's brought the world untold misery in many respects and some positive things. But the Asian system, the Asian set of beliefs that are you know, visible today, are much more beliefs that are tied to let's do business, let's not judge each other, you know, live and let live. And, you know, look at, you know, China dealing with Sudan, or look at Singapore's foreign policy or whatever, and you see examples of this. Well, what if that becomes an increasingly important view within this group? How does that shape public dialogue in the world? How does that shape policy in the world? How does that shape the way the planet looks going forward? That's an important thing. The other thing we do in the book is I go in and I look at who these people are. And I came up with a definition, you know. people who are able to influence millions of lives across borders on a regular basis. Three criteria, millions of lives across borders on a regular basis. And when you do that, you come up with about 6,000 people. Heads of the big companies, heads of the big financial institutions, heads of big governments, heads of big military organizations. Although one of the things that distinguishes this group from groups in the past is that military organizations are much less important than they used to be because the cost of modern warfare is so high and it's so much less likely than it was in the 18th or 19th century to actually use a war to achieve a goal, although we obviously still see that periodically. They're religious leaders, they're cultural leaders. You know, Angelina Jolie is probably in the group. Bono is in the group. Britney Spears is not in the group. But, you know, these are people who have influence and use their influence to help to change the world. And so, you know, we go and I look at them and talk about them and, you know, sort of provide the opportunity to meet some of them up close, do a census. The census is kind of an eye-opening thing because 94% of these people are men, which means that the single most underrepresented group in the power structure of the planet Earth is women. 51% of the planet's population, 6% of this group. Even in countries where women are serving in legislatures, the average number of women in a legislature is 17%. If you believe in representative government, you have to believe there is something egregiously wrong with the global system simply on that basis. Now, there are other things that, you know, are interesting in the demographic makeup of the group. We took a subset and looked at them and discovered that 30% went to one of 20 universities. That's kind of mind-boggling. This is 6,600 people from 180 countries, and a third almost went to one of 20 universities, including actually this one. It's probable that if I'd picked 40 universities, we could have made it 50%. What does this tell you? Well, on the one hand, it tells you that the knitting together of communities like this begins early. Now, you know, one of the other things that makes this elite different from past elites is it's much less an inherited elite, and that has led to a what I think is a kind of a myth that we live in a meritocracy, which is that anybody can get into these universities, and therefore, you know, the cream rises to the top. But of course, anybody can't get into these universities, even if everything were working perfectly. As we know, it's not working perfectly, but if everything were working perfectly, there are only a few slots. So just, you know, in terms of the size of the hole in the funnel, it's not an equitable thing. But just as gender is destiny in terms of this superclass and in terms of power in the world, so is geography. And if people just like you, with just your DNA and just your energy and just your abilities, were born in Papua New Guinea or in sub-Saharan Africa, they don't get to sit here. They don't get the abundance that you get. They don't get the jobs you get. They don't get anything you get. They're out of the money. They will not be part of this group. So you can't say it's a meritocracy if the vast majority of the people in the world aren't in it. And if they don't, you know, I mean, half the world or 2-3 billion people have never heard a dial tone. They're not in the planet in terms of the path to this kind of success. But even in the United States, the most prosperous country in the world, if you're in the bottom 60%, you've only got a 1 in 20 chance of making it to the top 5%. So mobility in this country, which is higher than it is in many countries, doesn't really exist in the way that you would think it did. And obviously, if 51% of the people are just, they're not even going to get into the room because they happen to be born the wrong gender, you know, the system isn't a meritocracy. And that, you know, I mean, the racial and religious and other kinds of filters that are applied in different societies have the same effect. So, you know, studying how this group is made up is very illuminating because it shows, you know, the one thing that is completely intellectually disreputable, which is that there are classes in society. And when I started to do this, some of my friends in Washington said, oh my God, don't call it superclass, don't do this, you're a communist. You know, this is Marxism, you know, and that's done. Although I have to say, I've now given, I don't know, 30 speeches on this. And in every place I give a speech, somebody stands up and said, didn't Karl Marx say that all this was going to happen? And, you know, I am a free market guy, you know. I'm the ultimate centrist. I worked for Bill Clinton and Henry Kissinger. Plenty of stories there, too. But, and a little schizophrenia, maybe. But the reality is that he did. And the reality is that the wacky euphoria of the early 90s, that we'd come to the end of history, that we'd solved all the big problems, it's nuts. Because the big problem that had divided the world for 200 years was, how do you achieve the equitable distribution of wealth in a society? And for the past 30 years, it's gotten worse to historical levels. We haven't solved that problem at all. Now, I'm not saying government's got to step in, but what I am saying is that we are at a point, at a sea change. You're seeing it a little with financial markets. You're seeing it a little bit in this political race. But we are just in the earliest days where people are going to start to recognize that you can't have representative government. You can't have equality. You can't have balance without having effective governance structures. And right now on the global stage, we have none. We have two kinds of global organizations, weak and dysfunctional, right? Some are weak and dysfunctional, you know, and that's because nobody wants strong global organizations. If one of you were to run for political office in the United States, and it seems to be very popular for people from Hyde Park to run for political office in the United States, if one of you were to run for political office in the United States and say, what I want to do is strengthen the UN, cede U.S. sovereignty to the WTO to make the world trading system work better, create a global financial regulatory body that would supervise all the global financial regulatory bodies in the world, create a world central bank, create an enforcement mechanism that if people have weapons of mass destruction or violate, you know, the nuclear nonproliferation regime, that it can go in and fix it, you'd be done. That's done. It's the third rail in politics. You can't talk about ceding sovereignty. But if you don't cede sovereignty, and I, by the way, think of it as extending sovereignty, if you don't have a connection between voters in the United States and voters in other countries and the mechanisms that counterbalance the power of the few, what have you given up in order to preserve sovereignty? You've given up democracy. And we live in an era, whether we like it or not, where an increasing amount of activity that is important to all of us takes place on a global transnational stage without effective governance mechanisms. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, there should be world government. You know, it's not going to happen, first of all. But I do think global governance structures, whether they're regulatory or they have to do with weapons of mass destruction or trade or some of these other things, are going to have to be strengthened. You know, now, of course, in the United States, we're having an incredibly enlightened debate on this in this incredibly enlightening presidential election, which, you know, once again today took another turn for the ridiculous in terms of what's being covered. Because we've got candidates, including the candidate, whoever you're for, your candidate has espoused something ridiculous. You know, no matter what party, and one of the things that unites the extremes in both party is their notion that somehow we can have a national referendum on globalization, which would be like having a referendum in 1815 on whether or not we would like to continue with the Industrial Revolution. This is a global, historical, irreversible trend. We either make the most of it or someone else makes the most of it. Instead, we're having a debate in the United States about whether or not we should build a 700-mile wall on a 3,000-mile border, which to me is the greatest monument to futility that any government could imagine, not only because it's a 700-mile wall on a 3,000-mile border, but because the purpose of the wall is actually to keep out the future. And you can't do that. So we have to figure out, how do we go from here? But instead we have a dishonest debate about, like, trade. You know, everybody else is the bad guy and we're losing all these jobs to trade. And of course, we're not losing jobs to trade. I mean, there's no statistical evidence to that effect at all. We're losing some. Some have been outsourced. But the vast majority of lost jobs in the manufacturing sector in the United States over the course of the past 20 years have been lost to progress, to productivity, to machines doing things better than people could do them. And no one is going to go and do a march in the street against productivity because, of course, you know, that's seen as a potentially a positive thing. Well, what we should be doing is talking about, how do you create jobs tomorrow? How do you help deal with people who've been dislocated? How do you create global mechanisms that ensure that trade is fair? Not how do we retreat from the inevitable? It's a microcosm. It's a microcosm of the discussion that will ultimately get us to some kind of effective structures of governance that ultimately may offset the influence of these elites. My guess, not going to happen for a long time, because sovereignty is such a sensitive issue, because globalization is so unfamiliar to people, because these elites are so entrenched in the process. And by the way, you know, when you get the book and, you know, you've come this far, really, you don't want to leave without it. But when you look at it, one of the things you'll see is that it does not take the view that all elites are bad or let's eat the rich. It does not say, here, buy your pitchfork and torch here and let's go and march on, you know, Citibank or whatever. You probably don't have to bother because Citibank's got enough problems as it is. But, what you know, some people in these elites are doing great things. Some of them are leaders because they should be leaders. There have always been leaders. Some of them are venal and nasty and mean. There's a whole section on shadow elites, like, you know, Osama bin Laden. Does he influence millions of lives across borders on a regular basis? Yes. He's part of this group. Does he, like, go to Davos and meet? No. I mean, you know, this is not like a cohesive community. It's like any other small community of 6,000 people. Some people work together, some people oppose. But when you look at them, they're the most powerful. And so if you want to understand your era, you've got to understand the most powerful. And if you really want to understand them, then you have to set aside the preconceptions, the paranoia, the conspiracy theories, and you got to say, what's real? The interesting thing is that when you do set aside all that stuff, and you do determine what is real, it's mind-boggling. The inequality is mind-boggling. The venality is mind-boggling. The power accruing to private organizations is unprecedented in the history of the world, not anticipated. When the first corporation was chartered in Sweden in the 15th century, the 14th century, Stora Kopparberg, which was a copper company, it still exists today. When that was, the idea was a company was part of the community. It was being given the rights of any other citizen. It was a legal fiction. Today, it's above it, bigger than it. Exxon has operations in 180 countries. Sweden has operations in 80 countries. Exxon has far more discretionary resources than Sweden, this comparably sized country. Sweden can lead the charge to the Kyoto protocols. Exxon can kill it. And I'm not just picking on Exxon. There are lots of companies out there. I mean, I think Exxon deserves to get picked on because, you know, the power structure of the energy industry is a perfect example of how laws are pushed into place, regulations are pushed into place, policies are pushed into place that are palpably bad for everybody. And now we live in a world in which climate change is perhaps the great crisis of our generation. And I get a little bit of optimism when I think about climate change, because this is one area that could move us towards more effective global governance, because alliances of the willing won't work there. Coalitions of the willing won't work with climate change. Everybody's got to be in, everybody's got to play, everybody's got to have the same rules. we need a new kind of global diplomacy and cooperation on climate change than we've ever had before on anything else. And if we can get to that, maybe it moves us forward into doing the thing that is most critical to achieving balance and fairness and effective governance, which is redefining community away from small areas where we live to the broader communities that affect our lives because we buy from them, we sell to them, their unrest affects us politically and so forth. And so there are big changes afoot. And this book, Superclass, is about the group that's at the middle of those changes. And it's asking the question, have they, like every other elite in history, come to the point where backlash is inevitable? And will that backlash become the defining change in our era? And how will it take place? Because every other time in history, the way the backlash manifests itself is some group rises up and they say, we represent the people. And then they get the power and they become the elite. The people get left on the side. All of history is a negotiation between the rich and super empowered and the people who can make their lives miserable. The ones with just enough power to upset the apple cart. Everybody else, the ones with no power, they're never at the table. And the way the deal always works is how much do you need to shut up? And then they get that and you achieve a period of stability. And if you think it's cynical, go back and look. Look at every event, you know, as it turns. Now, what's the backlash going to look like? Is it going to look like Hugo Chavez or Vladimir Putin or Mahmoud Ahmadinejad? Possibly. Is the backlash going to look like Eurosocialism or some capitalism with a Chinese face or something where there's a much bigger role for governments than in the sort of Reagan-Thatcherist U.S. version? Possibly. Is it going to come after several big global financial crises, require us to have global financial regulation? Possibly. My sense, all these things will happen. All of these things will compete. We will not live in the only era in history, despite what Francis Fukuyama said, we will not live in the only era in history in which there is one idea and everybody buys into it. There is going to be a competition. The competition will define our times. And it's going to be fascinating to watch, but it would be better to be engaged. It would be better not to just let it to happen to everybody. And the place you got to start is you got to understand what's going on. And so that's the reason that this book is cooked up. So you can see the people, see how they work, look at it objectively, not have, you know, some kind of polemic from the far left or the far right, and start to formulate a sense of how does it affect you and how do you affect it? Because the reality is, if you could get up and come here through the snow and rain, here in a community that's leading the world, then you're going to have a voice in this. That I think that's the whole idea behind International House and these conversations. So I'm happy to talk about any dimension of this. I think we've got a little bit of time. How much?
20 minutes.
So you've got a question. I'm happy to answer a question on any subject. Of course, if you'd just like to applaud for 20 minutes, that's fine as well. Yeah, go ahead.
So you talked a little bit about how collective action happens in the superclass. You say the sort of mechanism of the aligning of interests and that whenever that happens, then things start to move. How do you see that potentially working in relation to the last topic you addressed, which is global warming? Do you see anything now, or do you hypothesize anything in the future, any way in which that group might influence a solution, an engagement with the problem? And do you see any tension between that and what you point out is necessary, which is some form of global governance, perhaps, or increased cooperation to deal with the problem, because you say that they're kind of in tension. That is, a superclass and any sort of governance structure which could control it might be antagonistic to each other.
Well, I think that within this community, there are competing interests, and that you have groups that are actively seeking to address this issue in a positive way, whether it's all the companies working under the umbrella of things like the Clinton Global Initiative or, you know, some other climate change alliances or the NGOs, which and the heads of some of the biggest NGOs are certainly members of this group. And, you know, European governments have played a very important role in leading the way on this. And in fact, I think Europe, you know, in the United States, it was fashionable to say Europe is over. But the reality is Europe, because it believes in a bigger role in government, has created incentives which have created the kind of green energy and other businesses that are leading the world right now has played a big role. And so you've got a group like that. Now, you know, do we sort of think that, you know, an angel of annunciation is going to come to the oil industry and to the NOx, you know, the nationally owned oil companies and the big private oil companies, and they're going to all change? No. But some of them, BP and Chevron and some of the other, they're beginning to move towards a more balanced view. And I think that it's quite reasonable to expect that, you know, there will be some change. What's going to be the real precipitant? Is it going to be enlightenment? No, it's going to be crisis. What's really going to be the thing is that, you know, more polar bears will die or more polar ice cap will melt or, you know, more bad weather will happen. You know, Katrina probably, I mean, nobody knows whether Hurricane Katrina had anything to do with global warming. But it illustrated the point really effectively. And so people embraced it as part of the narrative. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take more things like that. And, you know, ultimately, I think it'll help us get to a point where standards can be set and enforcement mechanisms can be put into place. But, you know, I worry that it's going to happen after a lot of damage, not before.
Talk a little bit about the widening inequality gap in the world, but you also mentioned that real wealth for everyone has risen, especially in China. You mentioned that the inequality gap there is extremely large and is growing. But if you notice, 30 years ago, during the Cultural Revolution, everyone was poor. They were scraping for rice. Now the average person in the city has a television and maybe even a car. So my question is, how do you institute policies that fairly redistribute wealth without screwing up this growth? Because it's a real thing if you take China, for example.
Well, first of all, growth is a real thing. It's got to be acknowledged. Markets do a lot of good. They create further wealth, and wealth can then work its way down through society. So you don't want to throw out those mechanisms. But we have found ourselves in a situation where inequality, the Gini coefficient in China has gone from like 0.27 to 0.47, so it's grown fairly dramatically, and where those gaps are now threatening in many ways the political future of China. Because the gaps are not just between rich and poor, they're between rich cities and poor rural areas. They're between rich coastal areas and poor inland areas. And that threatens the fabric of the state. And so we have to remember that reducing poverty is only part of the question. Inequality, particularly, you know, the visibility of relative differences is politically destabilizing. And so what you want to do is what has worked effectively in the United States when things are working well and in other parts of the world, Europe and so forth, where we create systems to reduce the valleys, possibly reduce some of the peaks, so that you've got growth, but you don't have extremes that are destabilizing. Because destabilization is as bad as absolute poverty because it produces unrest and violence and a whole bunch of other things. And so it's a question of balance. You know, it's just what we shouldn't do is fall into false choices. Oh, well, government gets involved, it's going to get screwed up. You know, that's kind of the classic conclusion that's been offered here in the United States since, well, you know, the Chicago Boys. That all government is bad, which is ludicrous. And if you said all business was bad, or you said your business simply can't work efficiently, you know, you'd be drummed out of the core, because what you have to do is you have to figure out how to make it work and business, and that's the creative imperative within business. We need the same thing on the governance side. We need to make it work better. And right now it's not working in a number of key respects. It's not solving the problem in the global stage, and it's certainly not addressing this growing inequality.
I hate to ask a follow-up question, but a major part of your argument was that national governments basically have no efficacy for international businesses these days. So it doesn't seem like regular solutions like aggressive income taxes or corporate taxes will accomplish this, according to you. So how would you suggest that we...
You need international mechanisms. National governments are The Westphalian system for 400 years of making nation states the basic building block of global society is coming to an end. You need to recognize that just as that was born 400 years ago from a change in the reality of Europe, you know, the world is changing. And we need to have mechanisms that ensure stability within these systems. And I don't think we're going to get to global taxation. I don't think we're going to get to that at this point, but what I do think we will do is we will address some of the transnational issues that are really destabilizing issues, and that will set us on the right course. I think that a lot of this work will also be done within the nation states. They're not going away anytime soon. And you will see there will be a re-regulatory trend in the United States for the next 10, 20 years. That is just going to compensate for the pact that over the past 20 or 30 we moved away from it. It's, you know, and by the way, we're in the minority. You know, most, you know, there are plenty of countries in the world that are doing great, really, really well, with a different balance than what we have.
I mentioned I saw you on C-SPAN last week, so I'm really interested in this topic. As a University of Chicago grad, with almost 20 years' experience in the tech industry, I've experienced firsthand this whole globalization thing with the H-1B, L-1 visa. 3-4 years ago, John Rowe, the CEO of Exxon, made $27 million last year when I was displaced with cheap labor from China. So I experienced very directly this discrepancy in talk. I know that you don't think that building a fence is very effective, but the thing is, we're trying to regain some sort of accountability to our sovereignty with these transnational companies that think they're beyond everyone and aggravating this discrepancy in wealth that you talked about, which Jim Webb talked about in the State of the Union response a year ago, year and a half ago. So my question to you is, I've got two questions. First of all, do you agree that we're kind of reaching at a point where we saw around the mid-1800s when we had these sort of global companies sort of reaching out and then this colonialism following them in the sense that we have to have some sort of governmental control over these transnational companies? And secondly, can't we do that through via citizenship of these players who rely on their passport and that their respective governments to bail them out, let's say if they need some sort of military force to help their companies or patrol the Persian Gulf or whatever?
Well, look, I mean, clearly there are displacements, and I think we need to deal with the displacements that are caused by globalization. I think dealing with them in terms of things like trade adjustment assistance and so forth is playing at the margins. Where the real displacements take place is on the community level. When a factory is shut down, the community loses its tax base, it gets rid of teachers, it gets rid of highway repair people, it gets rid of cops, it becomes harder to attract a new factory into that town. If you don't attract the new factory, you don't have the jobs. So, you know, you've got to work at the community level in that respect. But in terms of, you know, keeping people in or keeping people out of the United States, you know, the reality is that the global market exists. And what we really need to be aware of is not who's coming in and who's coming out. Because I think, frankly, the United States has prospered enormously by bringing in smart people from the rest of the world and offering them opportunities here so they stay here and our intellectual base grows. What we have to recognize is that the rest of the world is training people differently, that the rest of the world is improving its educational system. If you look at the root of growing inequality in the United States, it comes from the fact that in the 70s, the average person had 4 years more education than their preceding generation. And today, the average person might have 0.6 or 0.7 years more education than the preceding generation. So we are failing. But the place we're failing is not our immigration policy. The place we're failing is our education policy, our infrastructure policy, where, you know, are you going to locate a factory in a country that can't keep its bridges and its highways growing? And in our recognition that what it's about is about the jobs of tomorrow, whether it's green collar jobs or new frontiers in the service economy or whatever. And so, you know, some countries approach this in a very innovative and constructive way. Singapore, every 2 years, they do a national competitiveness assessment. Public, private sector, academia, everybody gets together. And then it actually gets translated into policy. and they put money into the certain kinds of education programs. Now, that's industrial policy. I don't know if the United States is ever going to get to that. But what I do think is kind of tilting at windmills is thinking that we can change our policies and somehow force multinational corporations to come back and play by our rules. That day is over. Those companies will go someplace else. They will go where the taxes are better, the infrastructure is better, the employment is better, and you know the country that sets the loosest regime sets the overall rules for the market, and we've seen it here. I mean, we did Sarbanes-Oxley in order to get more transparency in our markets, and IPOs stopped happening in the United States, and they started happening in London. You know, I can give you 100 examples of that kind of thing. I don't think the genie goes back in the bottle. I think the question isn't, how do you call a timeout on globalization? I think the question is, how do you make globalization work for us? And that's
what American tech workers are going to be looking for, because a million people have been displaced since 2000 in the United States. These are highly educated people. I worked my way through the University of Chicago. How many people do you know have worked their way through Harvard or Yale or whatever? I mean, this is, it's reaching people like me now. This isn't a factory job.
No, I understand that. And I think that there are huge opportunities for well-educated Americans to go and play a role in creating those new jobs of tomorrow. But, you know, it's certainly not going to be something that we achieve by penalizing gardeners and fruit pickers. You know, that's not what's going to achieve that for us. What's going to achieve that for us is creating the kind of information infrastructure and educational system and tax incentives and other kinds of things that are going to make it possible for people to say, yeah, I want to invest in the U.S. and I want to take advantage of those workers.
State two statistics, as long as we're talking numbers. Illegal immigration has a 40% suppression of wages for poor working black people in this country. That is a fact. Second of all, between 2001 and 2005, 43,000 tech jobs or less were lost, and yet we are allowing hundreds of thousands of people on H-1B and L-1 visas in this country. Those are jobs that American citizens should be doing. High-end, highly educated, high-tech jobs being done at 50 to 30% less than what Americans would do this work at. Highly educated, high-skilled jobs. And that's the concern. And how do we make these companies accountable? And I think you can do it through the tax system. David K. Johnston talks about this in his book, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. And I think you can do it through reforming the H-1B and L-1 visa program, so that these companies can't say there's a shortage when really they're just looking for the cheapest labor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Hi, quick question. Where do you think this superclass elite community is thinking about taking us next?
Well, again, I don't think they're monolithic. So I don't know that they're all thinking of taking us anywhere. But what I do think,
if they're smart kids, they're not just predicting things.
Well, no, they are. But the point is, they're not all sitting in a room, you know, planning their next move. What I do think, though, is that global elites, particularly those who are, you know, running big transnational economic enterprises, are thinking about where's the growth going to be, and how do I get my share of the growth. How do I get more? And by the way, you know, I mean, there's a little section in the book called the psychopathology of success, and I may not be the best example, because I'm like writing books and I'm not, I do have a company, but it's not a global multinational company, but you know, if I made $3 billion last year, running a hedge fund, I'd stop. You know. I go to the beach, you know, so something motivates somebody when they make $3 billion to keep working. And it's part of it's that they're within a community where the scorekeeping is all different. But part of it is that most of these people who run these, power today is typically associated with an institution. That's the key accoutrement. It used to be connection to the land or something you inherited. Today, particularly on the private side, it's associated with an institution. The institutions have rules. The rules of these institutions are serve the owner. The owner of the institutions are the shareholders. What do they want? Profit and growth. And so they are driven not because they're evil or venal. They're driven because they're legally obligated to be driven, to seek out cheap labor, to seek out better tax environments, to seek out high growth environments. And so it's not a question that they're sitting in a room planning to go there. But over the next 20 or 30 years, you will see continuing booming growth in emerging markets because that's where the upside is. More billion-dollar companies exist today in the emerging world. You know, the fastest growing source of billion-dollar companies being created is in the emerging world. And, you know, clearly, Asia is going to be play a central role in all of this. And so, you know, I think rather than saying where do they intend to go, the real question is, where does it look like they're going? Well, it may be a quick question, but I can't vouch for the answer.
Sure. I was wondering if you could discuss the turnover and the companies that make up this ruling class and what leads to this turnover. It seems competition is probably one of the most important factors. That leads to the shorter second question, which is, these companies depend on customers actually buying their products. If customers decide to shift to a different company or a different product, it seems they essentially lose a great percent of their power. Doesn't this imply that common people also have some sort of power?
Well, first of all, of course common people have power. I mean, you know, it goes without saying, and they have all different kinds of power. They're, you know, democratic governments, they have the vote. And in, you know, other kinds of governments, they have the ability to take to the street. And they can influence markets through what they consume. But having turnover in these companies, having companies rise and fall, you know, that's taken place dramatically over the past 30 years also. But during that period, you've had enormous consolidation. Many of the companies that fail get consumed by other companies. And that consolidation has produced bigger and bigger economic entities with more and more power. So you can have turnover and you can have increasing disparities within this. And secondly, if one company falls to the side and another one is there to assume the role because it's been selling better, doesn't mean that the interests of that company are going to better align with the interests of people. And I think, you know, one of the important things, the flaws within I know you want to, you look like you want to make a point, but let me finish this one and then you can make your point. But one of the flaws within this leave it to the market approach is that even if the CEO of every company on earth were an angel from heaven, it's not their job to make the world a better place. Other people have to have the job of advancing justice and equity in the interests of people at large. We need a balance between those things. And on the global stage, where we don't have global governance mechanisms, the balance has shifted in a way that it hasn't shifted in the past. And that needs to be redressed in the same way that it has been redressed in every society since cave people.
It just seems that for a company to be successful, you're saying that the interests don't need to be aligned with those of the individual, but for the individual to actually demand the product, he has to decide that that's essentially that product is in his own best interest.
Yeah, but I mean,
saying that the individual is wrong, in which case he can have government.
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, wait a second. No, let me finish.
One problem could be the monopoly, which is essentially what you're saying.
What?
You're essentially saying the one problem is monopoly, which is not the same as saying the competition is pre-market.
No, that's, thanks, I appreciate it. If you're a consumer of toothpaste, you can help influence what kind of toothpaste is being made. You can't influence through your choice of toothpaste whether or not that company advances a whole set of other social policies, because companies don't advance social policies. That's not their job. And if you believe in the fundamentals of economics, then you have to believe in the division of labor. And companies have a responsibility within society that does not extend to the realm that is usually taken care of by the public sector. And if the public sector stops at a certain point in global society, and we are leaving all the other decisions to economic criteria, then we are going to end up with the kind of imbalances we've got today. Thank you.